Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hello, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. We have a very special guest on the show today, someone with a real incredible, motivational, inspiring story, someone who has persevered through all sorts of adversity and come out the other side as a champion and a winner. We have Chatri Sigatong on the show today. Now, for those of you who don't know who Chatri is, he is an entrepreneur and businessman from Thailand, and he is now the current CEO and chairman of the One Championship, which is a mixed martial arts championship, I think primarily based in Asia. So Chatri has an incredible story. He came from a very poor family in Thailand, and he always had a vision to become an entrepreneur. When he was 18, he managed to get into Harvard Business School in the United States, and he moved to America with no money. He just lived off a few dollars a day, and through graft, hard work, hustle, he managed to rise to become one of the top performers in his class. And when he graduated Harvard Business School, he was inundated with six-figure salaries and business opportunities to go work for some big firms. He turned all that down because he wanted to pursue his dreams of starting his own business and working in the martial arts industry. So some people thought he was crazy to do that. So he continued to be broke, but he kept working at it. I think he moved to San Francisco, started some businesses, made a lot of money, worked on Wall Street for a bit, and then he's now pursuing his passion in the mixed martial arts industry. So I'll let Rob and Chatri get into all the details. Chatri's gonna reveal all in this interview. But before we get started, if you wanna see the video version of this interview, head over to the Rob Moore YouTube channel and subscribe. You can watch this and all our other video interviews. So let's just get straight into it with entrepreneur Chatri Sigatong. But remember this, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here, and I am very excited. We have a very special guest, Chatri Sigatong, who is an amazing entrepreneur. He's got many accolades. I mean, listing them is going to be difficult. Asia's second most powerful person in sports, Black Belt Hall of Fame, Asia's most powerful person in martial arts, most influential executive in Asian MMA, most powerful person in Asian MMA. He's also very kind and generous. He bought 500 of my book, Opportunity. He's very humble, but also very disruptive. And his main company is One Championship, which is Asia's largest global sports group. So Chatri, thank you very much for joining the Disruptive Entrepreneur. We're doing a simultaneous live on Clubhouse. So I'm really excited. We've got loads going on. If it's okay with you, I want to do 4 or 5 rounds with you. So round one was the intro. We've done that. Round two will be your career. Round three will be entrepreneurial tactics. Round four will be a quick fire. And then round five, we're going to go into the Clubhouse room and talk to all of the panelists on the stage and do a Q&A session. How does that sound?
Sounds good, bro. Let's do it.
Okay, so question one then for you, Chatri, is why did you swap a really successful career in finance for a more risky career in martial arts?
So the story goes back further than that. And in a nutshell, when my father, many years ago, my father went bankrupt and abandoned the family. And my mother and I and my younger brother were dirt poor, living on 1 meal a day. And, you know, I'd never seen my mother cry until that time period. And I naively thought that if I just made a lot of money, then I would be happy because I would stop my mother suffering. You know, it really shattered my heart in a million pieces to watch my mother her whole life just blew up. And in Asia here, you know, the quote unquote marriage contract is about the husband going out to work for money and the wife staying home and being a homemaker, raising the kids. And that's just the way things are in Asia. Obviously, things are changing and becoming more westernized. But at the time when I was younger. And I was hell bent on making as much money as possible. And my mother, at one point when we were really down and out, my mother said, "Chatri, you're the oldest son, and it's your duty to rescue us or take us out of poverty." And at the time we had no house, no car. And my mother's idea was, you should emigrate back to America, because I'd been in America before, but I was in Thailand at that time. She said, you should emigrate to America and try your best to get into, you know, Harvard, and then you can get a great stable job, and then you can bring the rest of the family to America. And so that was a plan. But I didn't believe in myself at all. I mean, I wasn't an academic in any way. I mean, I was, for the vast majority of my elementary, middle school, high school, I was bottom one third. I got into fights all the time. I was suspended, sent to the principal's office, detention, all that stuff. So I didn't have any confidence in my abilities academically. But my mother, you know, she said, "Chatri, I really believe in you. And this is the path that the family needs to take." Long story cut short, I got into Harvard, and I really don't know how. It was probably like there were probably only three people from Thailand applying that year or something, you know, and maybe I was the best out of the three. I have no idea, you know, just total fluke. But when I got in, I remember for weeks I was telling my mom I'm not going to go because A, we don't have the money, and B, I'm not smart enough, and if I borrow money, I'm going to get kicked out. But my mother, you know, she really believed me when I didn't believe in myself. And that first week at Harvard, I came with a suitcase with all my life's belongings and about $1,000 that we'd scrounged up from friends and family. And I had to figure out very quickly how I was going to pay for school fees, for books, for my living expenses. And luckily, I've been a lifelong martial artist. So I taught Muay Thai. And I was a tutor at Kaplan and, you know, delivered food and got some financial aid. And I was very lucky that way. And I remember being very ashamed of my background, and I didn't want to tell people. And at the same time, I was full of fear, doubt, and insecurity. But, you know, I had a higher cause. I mean, I had to bring my mom out of the situation we're in. It got so bad that my mom ended up living with me in the second year in my dorm room. So we had a tiny little single dorm room, and I slept on the floor. My mom slept in the bed. And obviously the school administration had no idea. If they did, I would probably have gotten expelled. So, you know, going through all of that, you know, my whole purpose in life was never to see my mother cry again, never see her suffer. And I really thought if I make a shitload of money, that equates to happiness. So naively, I thought the answer was happiness. Roll forward a few years. I was on Wall Street. I owned a $500 million hedge fund, and I was on top of the world on paper. Inside, I had a record year. I think I was 35, 36 at the time. I had a record year, made tens of millions of dollars that year. And I went down to the sushi bar nearby the office, and I was by myself. And I had this adrenaline high of having a record year. And then I sat there and I just thought to myself, what is the point of my life? I'm buying and selling and shorting companies around the world. What value am I giving? And when I was a super, you know, when I was very, very young, like 5 years old, 4 years old, and throughout my, you're going to grow up to help people. You're going to grow up to help the world. She said those words, and maybe the subconscious, I don't know, but those words were echoing when I was in that sushi bar. And I just thought, rolling forward, what am I going to do? Buy more houses, buy more cars? What's the point? And I just had this really empty feeling. And so for weeks on end, I was in turmoil. I loved investing. You know, I enjoyed it. It wasn't like I hated it, my job, but I definitely felt empty inside. I was like, what am I really doing with my life? And I rolled forward till 8 years old. It doesn't matter how many billions of dollars you have, how many cars, how many houses at the end of the day. And I started thinking deeply about, you know, the meaning of life and purpose. And I realized that I was living society's definition of success, that society you know, you go to the right school, you get the right job, you do this, you do everything for your CV and your resume. And there wasn't this sense of purpose, deep sense of purpose in me. And I realized very quickly that I'd climbed up to the wrong, to the top of the wrong mountain. And when I told, and then I, you know, went to the deep introspection about what do I want to do? What do I love? What's the meaning of life and all this stuff. And I came down to something very simple. And I said, the meaning of life, at least for me, is, and it's something I live to this day. It's the love we share and the impact we make. And that's it. That's literally it. Nothing else matters. And so the point is, for me, is our purpose is to unleash our greatness in life by overcoming our fears, doubts, and insecurities, but really using our gifts on this earth, using our time on this earth to somehow make it better than how we found it for our loved ones, our friends, if we're lucky, our communities, our countries, and if you're very lucky, the world. And it comes down to all the love you share with the people that you care about most and the impact you make on the world. And that's it. And nothing else matters. After you die, nothing else matters. You can't take a Lamborghini or Ferrari. All that stuff means nothing, literally nothing. And so after a lot of introspection, I realized, you know, what do I love most? I went off to Central Park myself and I did some real introspection, trying to ignore everything that my friends and family and society tell me about what's right. And I had this very conservative Japanese mom. Her view of your son going to Harvard and you're now in Wall Street, you own a $500 million fund, that's her picture-perfect definition of success. So when I told my mom, you know, mom, I think I'm going to retire. This is not what I want. And she was very upset. She's like, Chacha, you're taking your success for granted. You're taking the fact, you're being very arrogant, the fact that you've forgotten the days where, you know, we were struggling in poverty. And you need to wake up, Chatri. You need to be appreciative and live with gratitude for your blessings. And of course, I still struggled with it. But in the end, I thought about what do I love most? What do I love most in life? And I grew up with martial arts ever since I was a kid in Thailand, doing it now, you know, 35 years every single day. I just came back from training. It's 10:30 p.m. right now in Singapore. And I just came back from the gym training martial arts. It's what I love, you know, and I want to dedicate my life to it. That's how I thought at the time. And so I told my mom, Mom, I'm thinking about retiring from Wall Street and I'm going to do this something crazy. I'm going to go back to Asia and I'm going to help people through martial arts. And my mom was like, that's the dumbest idea. Crazy. That's so stupid. My friends and family, literally everyone said I've lost it. The guy's, he's an idiot. He's stupid. He's crazy. Whatever. He's taken everything for granted and he's going to screw up his whole life. And, but something deep in me said, I need to do this. Like, this is what I need to do. At the same time, I saw an economic opportunity as an entrepreneur. Look, every region of the world has several multi-billion dollar sports properties. So you go to the US, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball. NFL is worth $100 billion. You go to Europe, same thing, EPL, F1, Champions League, La Liga, Series A. They're all worth tens of billions of dollars. You come to Asia at the time, there's literally no sports property, full stop, on a pan-Asian or global basis. There are country-specific sports properties like IPL, which is a billion-dollar property in India. Or actually, now it's a $10 billion property. At the time, it was a billion-dollar property doing cricket only in India. Then there was CSL soccer in China and J-League, a soccer league in Japan, and baseball in Japan. But there wasn't anything of significance on a global scale like NBA or EPL or F1 or Champions League. So I naively thought, man, there's 4.5 billion people here in Asia. I love martial arts. Asia's been the home of martial arts for 5,000 years. You know, millions of parents send their kids across the entire continent to martial arts schools all day, right? Since they're 5 years old, even now. So I thought, it's gonna be so easy, man. I'm just gonna launch this thing and 4.5 billion people are gonna rally behind this and it's gonna be great. The first 3 years literally were disaster. I mean, disaster on disaster. Rejection by every broadcaster. So I go to a broadcaster, a TV station, hey, I'm thinking about starting this new sports property and I'd like to air. And if possible, I'd like to air at Friday prime time. And they're like, that's so stupid. Like, we don't need a sports property. Asians don't like sports. We already have NBA. We have F1. We have Champions League. We have EPL. We have La Liga. We don't need an Asian sports property. And I went to brands. I went to governments. I went to, even employees. When I put a job rec out, no one applied because, you know, in Asia, people apply for something very, you know, your parents or society tells you, go be an accountant, go be an engineer, go be a doctor or a lawyer, whatever, something safe. Not sports. Sports is something you can't make money off of. Art, you can't make money. That's kind of Asian mindset. And so for the first 3 years, nothing happened. Like burning millions of dollars, throwing events, desperately trying to get on TV. We were on some TV and slowly, we were trying to get traction. But at the end of year three, my best friend and I had burned through millions of dollars of our own money because it just, the business was going nowhere. And I remember at the end of year three, calling my mom. I pick up the phone and say, Mom, I think I'm gonna quit. And my mom said, in Japanese, she said, see, I told you so. You should have listened to mommy, And obviously that hurt. But then we had a long talk about life and stuff. And then she just, at the very end of the conversation, I remember very well, she said, why don't you just quit? And then after that, we hung up and I started thinking about, why don't I just quit? And then I just go back to the original plan of, why did I even start this company? And people think, oh, it's about fighting. Yes, it's about martial arts, but actually the mission, and it hasn't changed at all since day one, since that business plan, the mission is not about putting on fights. Yes, we have the best world champion martial arts competing against each other. But the mission is this: unleash real life superheroes who ignite the world with hope, strength, dreams, and inspiration. That's literally the mission. And how did I come up with it? Again, it was a lot of soul searching about what do I want to do and how do I want to help the world or help people, as my mom would say. If I could create heroes who, through their life stories, could inspire the world. And I came down with a very simple formula: values, heroes, and stories. Values, I wanted to celebrate values that every family could celebrate with their kids and grandkids. Values of integrity, humility, honor, respect, courage, discipline, compassion, the true martial arts values. And then heroes, I wanted to create heroes who would inspire and unite entire countries. And then stories, tell their stories of overcoming impossible odds, tragedy, adversity, poverty, whatever it may be. And that would inspire humanity. And that was my mission. And it became my mission in life. And so when I started thinking about, martial arts is my greatest passion in life. It has been all of my life. I mean, anybody of my childhood friends, even my friends today, like, that's the martial arts guy. Chachu's the martial arts guy. He's the fighter guy. That's just who I am. So it was my greatest passion in life. I had a very deep sense of purpose about what I wanted to do. And, at the time too, and even if now it's even worse, look around media today, CNN or any kind of media. They only write about negative stuff: murder, rape, crime, Donald Trump, war, whatever it is, because that's what generates clicks and that's what generates advertising dollars. So the whole world was shifting at the time too into this negative, hateful, angry place. Unfortunately, it's devolved even worse than that now. And I said, I want to create a company that's genuinely going to be a beacon of hope and strength and inspiration for humanity. And that was my naivete. I was lucky. I had no media industry experience. I had no sports industry experience. I had no experience. I just was a hardcore entrepreneur all of my life. My first company I started when I was 27 in Silicon Valley, software company. And then I started a hedge fund in Wall Street, and then, done other businesses. And this is obviously the biggest business I've done so far. And so I ended up not quitting. And thank God I didn't quit, because I always joke, but I'm actually very serious, that I'm the Forrest Gump of sports. Why? Because exactly at that moment, Facebook, unbeknownst to me, decided to make a big bet on Asia. Smart mobile devices, also the penetration of smart mobile, hadn't taken off yet in Asia. Those two things literally saved one championship. If I didn't have those two things, it would have been a nightmare. I mean, I'd probably not around anymore. We started putting videos on Facebook and went viral. So the next year, the year after my mom, told me to quit, I didn't quit. Next year, we had about 150,000 organic video views online. Last month, we crossed 1.2 billion organic video views online. We're on pace for about 16 to 20 billion, not million, billion video views organic this year across the continent of Asia. And on top of it, we're now broadcasting 154 countries on TV in prime time on Friday, every Friday across the continent of Asia and around the world. And why I say it's Forrest Gump, I didn't know about Facebook or smart mobile devices. But here's the crazy thing: on a mobile device, you can't see a golf ball, a soccer ball, a basketball, or any other, and you're not going to sit here 90 minutes watching a baseball game. But you can see a martial artist do a spin kick and go for a beautiful KO. It's short and it's entertaining content. Boom. And so, long story short, cut short, in the worst moments, Sequoia Capital, which is the legendary venture capital firm out of Silicon Valley, you know, invested in Apple when their three employees and Google and YouTube and WhatsApp and Airbnb, all the legendary. In fact, 26% of the NASDAQ today is funded by startup phase from Sequoia Capital at early stage. Sequoia made a big bet. We were their first sports investment. And what happened was I was at breakfast. Michael Moritz, the chairman of Sequoia Capital, and Douglas Leone, the global managing partner of Sequoia Capital, had flew to Singapore and we had breakfast. And after an hour breakfast, Michael Moritz said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, "Josh, you're an authentic founder." And I said, "I don't, what does that even mean?" He goes, "There are founders who start companies who clearly are just going to sell the company. There are founders who start a company who it's just one part of their journey. And then there's founders who start a company and that's their life." And he says, "My equity is going to compound on your passion and the fact that sports businesses are the most powerful economic business models on the planet." I mean, think about it. If you and I, Rob, were going to displace EPL or Champions League or NBA, we could raise $10 billion and there's no, we have zero probability chance of undertaking, overtaking and knocking NBA or EPL or Champions League off its pedestal. It's impossible because it's part of the fabric of society, of culture, of institutions, of children's dreams. And so Michael Moritz said that. And he also told me an anecdote. He said, "Chatri, when I started the venture capital business, I remember I went to my very first investment conference. I saw this guy on stage and he was projecting 10 million sales that year. His name was Bill Gates." I just look at this guy. I'm like, so Sir Michael Moritz, you know, he ended up investing in Steve Jobs instead of Bill Gates. But the point was, he was telling the story of like, when you find an authentic founder behind a great business model going after a massive opportunity, right? I mean, what the opportunity set for one chapter is genuinely $100 billion. I mean, that's what we're gunning for as my leadership team, my board, myself. We crossed the $1 billion mark a couple of years ago. We're now a few billion. And now, you know, in the next 3 to 5 years, hopefully cross $10 billion mark. And then eventually we're off to the races against NBA and NFL, et cetera. But again, Forrest Gump, because, you know, I didn't know anything about sports, didn't know anything about media. And I started the company thinking I could unite 4.5 billion people. It would be easy. Forrest Gump, because if Facebook wasn't around for our viral videos to go crazy, I would have no data to show the broadcasters. So that's what the tipping point was. Once we start putting videos on Facebook and they start going viral, I would take the stats and go to the TV broadcasters and go, "Hey, Mr. Broadcaster, take a look. It's a millennial audience and the content is flying." And then mobile devices just took off. Everybody ended up owning a mobile device, a smart mobile device in Asia. So it was a confluence of a lot of lucky things that happened along the way that gave birth to One Championship and what it is today. And of course, I work hard. Of course, my team and I work hard, but it is a lot of luck if I look back on the journey.
Wow. So that was question one. And you've answered questions 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Oh, I did? Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you were... Sorry about that, bro.
No apologies. I'm really enjoying this. Challenges. Two questions. And that is, one, what challenges have you had through the pandemic? And two, what challenges have you had raising hundreds of millions of venture capital and being accountable to them? And I just want to say thank you to all the panelists who are on the live on Clubhouse. That was round two. Going to move into round three and four, and then going to bring you all in on the conversation. We had 1,000 people in the room, Chatri. So this is going great.
Awesome. So, sorry. What was the first question? I've been punched in the head too many times over my lifetime. Sorry. What was the question?
Two challenges. One, pandemic.
Yeah, okay. Right. Yes. Okay. So March of last year, the Singapore government, we're headquartered in Singapore. We have offices in different parts of the world, but we're headquartered in Singapore. The Singapore government decided, after about 100 cases a day, that they were going to shut down the whole country. Shut down meaning every single person has to stay at home. They're not allowed to leave the house. or you go to prison, except for buying groceries. So you have to imagine overnight, the Singapore economy shut down. Everything was shut down. Borders were closed. And the first couple of days, I'm like, man, this is like the worst case scenario for a live sports event, right? Imagine. And actually, NBA was down, NFL, EPL, everyone was shut down at the time. And I didn't know if it was going to be 1 month or 12 months or 24 months. And I remember the first couple of days, I was really depressed. I was like, man, and disappointed and frustrated. I'm like, man, I spent the last several years building this thing, and now this pandemic can wipe us out. But after like, it was like the third day, I don't know what happened. I woke up and I thought to myself, this is the worst crisis in 100 years. And I should be inspired by this because this is an opportunity for me and my team to prove that we are extraordinary as a company. And, you know, it's almost like you have to, in the martial arts world, right? If you win all the time, it means nothing. You only know who you are after you go through a very hard battle, whether it's in training, in the ring, whatever it is. That's when you really know who you are. And then I just thought about it, and I held a company meeting, and I told my team, this is the worst crisis in 100 years. Let us embrace it and use it as a way to see how great we are. If we're just average guys, we will suck and we'll go under. There's no question. If we are phenomenal, we will deliver phenomenal results. And the most important metrics internally, okay, the health metrics of any media property, so whether it's Facebook or even WhatsApp or Instagram, is what we call internally at One Champion, RFE, reach, frequency, and engagement, or even Clubhouse. Reach is the number of users actually using the app or consuming your content. Frequency, how often are they doing it? Every day, every week, multiple times a day, you know, once a month, whatever it is. And engagement, how many hours a day versus, or how emotionally attached are they to Liverpool or Manchester United or whatever it is. So RFE are the most important health metrics. And as I mentioned, just as one proxy, our online organic online video views went from 150,000 annual to this year, we're going to hit about 16 to 20 billion. But when last year hit, I thought our RFE was going to drop like a cliff, drop like a hard rock, you know, and end up, I don't know, getting down 90%. And that would have been a very, very big problem for any sports property. Because our job is to put content out live and non-live and post-produce, life stories, action highlights, all that stuff. And we were down for 3 months. We were one of the first global sports properties, you know, we beat NBA, NFL, EPL, all of them in terms of coming back online. So we had our first event in June in China, and then Thailand in July, and then eventually Singapore. And now we're having events almost every week, roughly every week. And I challenged my team. I said, these are the two ingredients you need to succeed in the pandemic. First is creativity. We need creativity because we're going to be faced with problems we've never seen before. So we need to think always outside the box. How do we solve a problem we've never seen before? Second, I said, equally important is resilience. We're going to get more rejections, more failures, more setbacks, more obstacles than ever before. So we have to be resilient and you know, in the martial arts world, we call it bite down on your mouthpiece. When you know you're going to get hit in the face, you bite down and you charge. And I said, that's the mindset we have to have. We're going to war now. And I challenged the whole team. And despite only operating 9 months of last year, our TV viewership was up 50% versus the prior year, which was operating at 12 months, 2019. And our online metrics, you know, social, digital, et cetera, were up 300%. And so we had an extraordinary year last year and I owe it all to my team. They literally worked 24/7 against all odds, you know, and I have to also thank the Singapore government. They believed in us. You know, they entrusted us as the first property in sports, music, or entertainment, full stop, in Asia, across Asia. We were the only ones coming back. So we led the entire continent of Asia in terms of coming back with a live broadcast, live event to 154 countries. And then also we ended up shooting The Apprentice, in October, which I'm the star of, right? I'm the first... The Apprentice is coming out with its first global edition ever. And MGM, MGM and myself worked it out. And so I would do it. But then we had the pandemic. And so we had to bring in 16 contestants from around the world in the middle of the pandemic, shoot this entire show. But at the same time, I didn't want to do the same apprentice that we see that Alan Sugar is doing or any of the ones you've seen in the past. I said, if I'm going to do it, I want to do something completely revolutionary. So what I did was every episode is kind of like an Amazing Race adventure where you have to compete or get inspired by our world champions. So I brought in our world champions. And so we had things like, you know, the candidates had to jump off a 150-foot bridge. They had to be submerged underwater, upside down in a helicopter and escape in a sinking helicopter. Crazy things like that. In addition, they had to do the business challenges. And in the business challenge, what I did was I invited my CEO friends from around the world to be a CEO judge with me, a co-judge, kind of like Shark Tank. So Eric Yuan from Zoom, Anthony Tan from Grab, which is one of the decacorns here in Asia, the Uber of Asia, a bunch of other CEOs from around the world who ended up joining the you know, one CEO per episode. Just ask my friends to come on board. So there's a little bit of everything in this. There's reality drama, but there's high stakes action in terms of, you know, adventure stuff and then business challenges. And then on top of it, you have these incredible CEOs sharing their knowledge. So all of that was literally in the middle of the pandemic. And again, like I said, I'm blessed to serve what I believe is one of the greatest teams in the world. I mean, my team is just went above and beyond everything to be able to pull this off. And obviously the Singapore government also really believing in us, partnering with us and allowing us to do this safely. So that's challenges.
Love it. What makes a great leader, Chatri? We've actually done rounds 1, 2, and 3 on my list. Round 4 is the quick fire. Round 5 is the Q&A with the panel and the audience on Clubhouse. So this is the end of round 3. What makes a great leader?
For me, a great leader is a few things. One is someone who really has a servant mindset in terms of understanding what his or her team's needs are individually, especially your direct reports. You really know people are not necessarily only motivated by money. So money is one aspect, but learning and growth is another. Responsibility, a sense of purpose and mission. And obviously, you know, promotion and titles and all those stuff matter a lot. So in a business context, a leader is someone who really understands what drives the team, what inspires the team to greatness. And I say there's three things in terms of what a great leader does. And this is the same thing for military, for fighting in the martial arts world. You know, I deal with world champions all the time. It's three things. One, a great leader has to inspire greatness in his or her people. And inspiring greatness is not an easy thing. It's think about a war. When a general knows he is going to send 5,000 men and women to battle, and he knows 4,000 are not going to come back. And yet he needs 5,000 people to go as if they're going to all come back. Inspiring greatness is when you are able to impart a sense of purpose that you're fighting for something much bigger than yourself. See, when human beings fight for something bigger than themselves, extraordinary things happen. That's how people win Olympic gold medals. That's how people go to war. You know, the Navy SEALs, you know, kill Osama bin Laden. Extraordinary feats in life require the sense of I'm doing something because of something much bigger than myself, whether it's honor and glory for my country, whether it's my mother's dying of cancer, whatever the cause is. If you're doing it because, hey man, I want to make $1 million and make $10 million, the very weak motivation in life. You have to have something higher, a higher cause, because at the end of the day, we are thinking animals, human beings. The second is you have to authentically care about your team, about your people. And people know authenticity, right? If you genuinely care about your people, they know it. And why is that important? Because, you know, a leader must create the sense, not only inspire greatness, but create a sense of safety, psychological safety, so that performance can be maximized. And I always say culture is the engine of extraordinary performance. So what do I mean by that? If you have inspired people who come to work and they genuinely love their jobs, they love each other, they love the purpose, and they have a deep sense, they're going to do extraordinary things versus 95% of the world. I don't really like my job. My company is just about making money. I do 9 to 5, check in, check out. I make good money. I have a mortgage. I have a car. And this is my life. But there is no passion. There's no sense of purpose. There's no real killer instinct about doing something extraordinary with your life. And the third thing, I really believe the responsibility of a leader is to be tough. Because if you hire superstars who are genuinely inspired, They don't want to work for someone who's lazy, who has no standard of excellence, someone who has no dreams, someone who has no grit, no resilience. And so your job is to bring out the very best by being tough, holding the standard of excellence, and making sure people deliver on it. But again, it comes with those three things, right? If you're unable to do one of those things, then just being tough alone means nothing. It means you're an asshole. But if you're able to do those three things, right, then it creates something magical happen. You know, something magical can happen. And I always say culture is the engine of extraordinary performance. Now, of course, every leader has strengths and weaknesses. You know, my weakness, biggest weakness is that I'm very intense and I have a very bad temper. So if people are not able to live up to my standards of excellence, it's not a fun time for anybody. I'm working on it, but you know, I try my best to focus on three simple things, like in terms of making what makes a great leader. So hopefully that answered your question.
That's absolutely brilliant. So that's the end of round three, and we're going to move into round four now. And we're coming towards the end now. Now, this is a challenge, Chatree, but I know you're up for a challenge. I know you like it. These answers need to be 1 to 2 sentences, because that's the fun of the quick fire, to take the massive information you have and get it into 2 sentences. So I'm going to ask you 2, 4, 6, 8, 11 questions, which I think are fun and interesting. And you got to do them if you can. I mean, you're a black belt, so you do what you want, because you'll just armbar me. But if you can, answer them in 2 sentences or less. And then once we've done this, we're going to open up to Q&A discussions, debate, and have a load of fun in the clubhouse room for the next hour. So first question, I know you went to Harvard Business School. So Harvard Business School or the hard knocks of business life, what taught you the most and why?
For sure, the hard knocks of life. I actually don't believe, this is going to sound kind of, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but I don't believe in CVs. I don't believe in degrees. I don't believe in fancy qualifications at all. Zero. I feel blessed that I went to Harvard Business School, but I also met a lot of idiots from there. Not to say I didn't meet some smart people as well, but over the course of my life, I've realized that people come from all walks of life and all circumstances. So if you have somebody, and I'm just going to use an extreme example here. If you have somebody who was born rich, never went through adversity, and got all the best tutors, got great test scores, great academics, then went to Harvard. Then you take someone else who was born dirt poor, went through crazy stuff. His mom and dad ended up being an orphan by 10 or something crazy like that. And somehow he or she ended up in a no-name university, but somehow on full ride scholarship. I'll take that person any day over the Harvard person. So I think society overweights too easily credentials of what company you worked at, what your resume looks like, what your CV is, what school you went to, when the real truth of a person's greatness is not about what's on a piece of paper. It's actually on the pivotal moments of their lives, the choices they made, the decisions they took. Did they exhibit integrity? Did they exhibit grit and resilience in moments that mattered most? Or do they quit? What do they do? And I want to find out about their life story. What was the worst year of their life? You know, who do they blame? Do they blame themselves? Or do they blame the world? There's so many other things that matter that really translate into success. So I'm grateful for my Harvard days, but it's just a point in time for me. It's not who made me, and it's not a big contributor to my success. I would say what it is I have a lot of grit, I have a lot of resilience, I have a warrior spirit given to me by my martial arts training. I have a lot of these other values. So I do my best not to judge people by their paper credentials.
Okay, great. If you just mute while I talk, Chatree, that's great. That's a brilliant answer. You like tough leaders, so I'm going to be a tough leader. I'm going to push you. Each answer needs to be 2 sentences.
Okay.
Second question, 2 sentences. What's the single greatest opportunity right now?
Content creation, because the world is shifting where if you own IP, you own content, very much like One Championship or any other individual content creators as well. The monetization abilities, the scalability globally, the geographic boundaries are breaking down everywhere. The intermediaries are also breaking down. For the first time in history, content creators can go direct and borderless. So if you're an outstanding content creator, you will win all the time. Sorry, that was more than two sentences. I will be better. Sorry.
It got better. By the way, it's another great answer. You're getting some rounds of applause on the mic tap for the shorter nature there of the answer. Right. Two sentences, Chatree. I'm really enjoying this, by the way. I hope everyone in the audience and the panel is. I'm really enjoying this. Third question, two sentences. Why does poverty create great entrepreneurs?
Two things. It gives you compassion and empathy, understanding going through really, really tough times. But at the same time, it also gives you grit and resilience, a warrior spirit.
Boom. That was two sentences spot on. Fourth question in two sentences, this one. What is success?
The love we share with our loved ones, our family, our community, and the impact we make on the world. That's it.
Next question in the quick fire. What is happiness?
Living when your passion and purpose are aligned, when your mind, body, and spirit are aligned with who you are, and you're able to devote your life to something very meaningful to you. See, I'm going to run a little bit longer because this is a very important topic. too much of the world is extrinsic. I'm going to do something because I want to look good to somebody or society. Or keeping up with the Joneses. I want to buy a Ferrari to show everybody I'm rich. But actually, the wealthiest people don't own Ferraris. That's the reality of life. I mean, it's if you're a millionaire or multimillionaire, you'll own a Ferrari. But if you're beyond that, then it becomes like potato chips. You just buy a bag of potato chips. It has no meaning. And people search for meaning. And so for me, I'm sorry, I hope I don't offend anybody who owns Ferraris. I'm not saying I'm against Ferraris or whatever, but I'm saying,
I'm going to sell my Lamborghini, my Ferrari.
Sorry, I'm probably offending a lot of people tonight, but at least I'm just speaking my mind here. I think that is, for me, being intrinsic, listening to your soul, listening to your heart, not what your mom tells you, not what your dad, not what your husband, not what your boyfriend, not what your girlfriend, not what your wife tells you, not what society tells you to do. But you do it because you genuinely believe that's what you want to do, and that's how you want to express your soul. That's what you want to do with your life. At the end of the day, we all leave this beautiful earth. What do you want to do with your life? Not what society is asking you to do.
Love it. Right. Back to two sentences. Best advice you ever remember receiving?
My mom, when I was 5 years old, you're going to grow up to help people. And I think when we help people genuinely, and I'm not talking about trying to make money, but help people genuinely, there is deep meaning and purpose.
Worst advice you ever remember receiving?
Probably to myself, money is everything. Money is happiness. The worst advice ever. And I lived it.
What one thing is wrong with the world that you'd love to change or you are changing?
There's so much negativity and hatred and anger and bullshit in the world. I mean, I'm trying to stick to sense. I wish that humanity could come back to a place where there's goodness in the world and inspiration and just goodness.
If there's one person on this planet alive that you would drop everything to listen to in an interview like this, maybe even for the disruptive entrepreneur, who would it be and why?
Bruce Lee, because even though people think of him as a martial artist and a fighter, he was a very deep philosopher on how to live life. And if anyone really wants to crack the code of purpose and passion, read his books, and it just his philosophical work is just unbelievable in terms of how to unleash your greatness in life.
I'm probably going to struggle to get Bruce on the show. So can you also pick an alive guy?
Somebody alive, I would say Angela Lee, one of our world champions at one championship. At 19 years old, she became the youngest world champion in the history of martial arts globally. She is kind, intelligent, strong, independent, an inspiration to the world. And someone obviously who's done an incredible lesson, that she's obviously a multimillionaire. She's 22 now. But she's just such an inspiration. And she's one of the faces of one championship because, again, what was my mission of one championship? She's one of the faces because I know that she can change the world through the way she lives by inspiring people. So Angela Lee is definitely someone that I really admire.
This podcast is called The Disruptive Entrepreneur. And what does the word disruptive mean to you? Two sentences. Maybe we can do four sentences for this one. I have a feeling you're going to have a long answer on this.
Doing things better, faster, cheaper, or different, and breaking the rules because they don't make any sense anymore to the world we live in.
Boom.
But doing so with integrity and living ethically, very, very important.
Wow, Chatry. So anyone watching the live, thank you very much. This has been Chatry and Rob on The Disruptive Entrepreneur. We're now going to Clubhouse for an hour or so to debrief, discuss, have a bit of fun, get the panel involved. If you are watching the live and you're on Clubhouse, we'll see you on Clubhouse. Remember this, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything. Make sure you follow Chatry Sijitong. Chatry, where can people follow you? You know, are you active on socials? Where should they go?
Yeah, I'm really not very good at social media because I post like once every few weeks instead of every day like you're supposed to. But people can follow me at YODCHATRI. That is the name my martial arts master gave me when I was a kid. Chatry means actually warrior. My name means warrior in the Thai language. And Yod, Y-O-D, means extraordinary. I did end up being an extraordinary warrior, though, in the ring. But
love it. So, Harry, if you finish the live, thanks for tuning in, everyone, on the live. We're going to Clubhouse. How you doing, panel?